Okay, there's a couple loose ends last week, and we have a lot of material, so I'm not going to have a chance to really go into either of these loose ends properly. Very quickly, the Gemara in Sanhedrin that I mentioned, that's Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Bet 21b, asked the question, why is it that the Torah is not megale, does not reveal the reason for the mitzvot? And the Gemara continues over there, it's speaking about Shlomo and the problem of having too many wives and too many horses. And it says, you see what happens when the Torah does give reasons. Here there was, I think it's called the Gadol HaOlam, the Gemara refers to Shlomo HaMelech as Gadol HaOlam. There was the Gadol HaOlam who made a mistake. He saw that the reason is explained in the Torah, why not to have too many horses, you'll go back to Mitzrayim, why not to have too many wives, they'll lead your heart astray. And he said, well, I see the reason doesn't apply to me, so therefore I can do it. And you see that, in fact, he stumbled in both of these instances. So says the Gemara. Right? If we remember, that creates a bit of a problem for what we were saying last week, that the Gemara in general, even if you take the more conservative position of Rabbi Yehuda, feels that trying to look at what the reason for a mitzvah is, and therefore shape the contours of the mitzvah based on that reason, is perfectly legitimate. It's something that we're supposed to be doing. The only question was whether the Torah has to explicitly state the reason or not. But if it states the reason, then you should be able to look at that reason and again, shape the applications of the mitzvah based on the reason, like we explained last week in Shiloh HaKen, in sending away the mother bird. We'll give another one or two examples this evening as that as well. And because we don't really have time to go into this Gemara, but the Meiri over there on the Gemara, anybody, I'm going to say a lot of Mari Mekomot, anybody who's interested in looking further, all the sources that I bring should take these downs. And then it was the Meiri is the first to ask the question, as far as I know, the first to ask the question, what's the Gemara talking about? What do you mean the Torah doesn't give reasons? Right, what about Shabbat? What about Sukkot? What about all this whole list? In fact, if you want a better list, I think the Torah Tmima in Dvarim Yud Zayin goes through a whole list. And there's more. The truth is, there are many mitzvot that the Torah tells you why you should be doing them. Right? So what does the Gemara mean? Why does the Torah not give the reasons? The Torah does give the reasons. So the Meiri, I remember the Meiri's answer. But essentially what they say is this type of, if I'm correct, it was a Neri, I think Torah Tmima says the same, the Margoliot Hayam, Rav Reuven Margoliot on Sanhedrin also mentions this issue, and at least the Neri, and I think that the Torah Tmima, probably all three of them say, that what we're talking about is mitzvot that are built as a geder. In other words, that there's no intrinsic value. When the Torah presents a mitzvah with no intrinsic value, then it's better not to give the reason. What I mean with no intrinsic value? Again, let's take the example that the Gemara gives. That having too many horses intrinsically is not problematic. There's nothing really wrong. What's the problem? The problem is that it will lead Jews, the Jewish king, rich Jews, whoever it is, to go to the World Trade Center of horses. Where is that World Trade Center for most of ancient history? That was Egypt. So therefore, the real problem is going down to Egypt. The Torah, however, builds a fence for us. The fence, intrinsically, is not important. But the problem is, if the Torah gives you the reason and illustrates to you beferush, explicitly, that the actual commandment has no intrinsic importance, and people are going to come and violate the mitzvah. In those cases, except for the example that Gemara speaks about, the Torah does not give reasons. In any case, the point is clear, even from the simple meaning of the Gemara is problematic and certainly has to be marginalized in terms of what we've discussed up to now. In other words, this Gemara is not going to be a problem. Yes, the Torah does give reasons, and even where it doesn't, it's perfectly legitimate to do what Rav Shimon bar Yochai did, is to look for the reason. And even to the point, as Rav Shimon bar Yochai did, to try to determine the contours of halakha based on that reason. Again, it's a machloket between him and Rav Yehuda, and we tend to follow Rav Yehuda, but it's not to say it's not legitimate, simply not the road that we generally follow. That was one loose end. Another loose end, I mentioned a Shuta Rashba. I don't know if they give you the place, the Rashba, Chelek Aleph, Tshuvat Sadi Dalid, where the Rashba is also asked about the mitzvah Shiloh HaKen. It's not clear, the Rashba doesn't bring the question separately, he integrates it into his answer. It's not exactly clear what the question was, nor is the answer very clear. It seems to turn into a real hashkafic discussion. One of the questions that the Shoel, that the person who sent to the Rashba asked, is how is it that Avram could... I don't think it was Avram, was it? How is it the Avot kept the mitzvot if the mitzvot weren't given till Har Sinai? It's a classical question. Ramban deals with it. And especially the Shoel asks, well, what's going on with Yaakov marrying two sisters? Again, a classical question that's asked. Apparently it's a long discussion in terms of what the questioner asks, but in the context of the answer, and there seems to be something about Shulach Ken, the whole issue of reasons come up. What are the reasons for the mitzvah? And in this discussion, the Rashba has a whole lengthy discussion about that. In fact, we only know the tip of the iceberg. He says even when the Torah does give you the reason, he mentions Shabbat and Sukkot as examples. He says, well, when you know, Zechel Maaseh Bereishit, but it's much more than that. You know, we experience understanding the world and remembering God and all sorts of levels of consciousness. I mean, I was reminded of the Likutei Maharan. In terms of everything that Rabbi Nathan and Rabbi Nachman stuck into Shabbat, so obviously we're not dealing with the same hashkafot, but the Rashba would say there's so much in the mitzvah that you can't possibly think that you actually know the full explanation for the mitzvah. Now, in this particular tshuva, the Rashba doesn't really speak about the next step. The obvious next step would be what? If you can't really know the reasons for the mitzvah, then, on a legal level, what would the conclusion be? What would that mean, if you can't know the reason? You can't determine based on any reason that you see, even when the Torah itself gives you the reason. Right? And really, the reason is there sort of as an icing on the cake. It's a nice thing to know, but you can't really do anything with it halachically. There's no room for legal interpretation based on Tamei HaMitzvah. The Rashba, in that very tshuva, clearly speaks about Kabbalah, and clearly the Kabbalistic approach to Tamei HaMitzvah is going to complicate matters greatly. Anybody who follows the Kabbalistic school is going to complicate any attempt to try to determine halakha based on its reasons. For one reason, the Rashba says, you know, even though there are reasons, it's very interesting what the Rashba does over there. He says, even though there are reasons, there are a lot of reasons al piatzot, right? Why we should be doing Shiloh HaKen. So, to take that example, and I'll give you another example of this later in the shiur, we should be able to take all the reasons, both niglev and nistar, both what we know based on the psukim and divrei chazal, as well as what we know from divrei kabbalah, from the zohar, wherever you want, and see, based on all these reasons, as by the way, in the discussion of the Chatam Sofer said, you know what, one could say that al pi kabbalah, there's a reason, in other words, they say it's cruelty to send the mother bird away if you don't have a reason to do so. Right? But there can be more than one reason. One reason is the obvious one. You need what? The eggs. You want to eat the eggs, right? But another reason is because the Zohar tells you bring rachamim to the world by doing so. So that's a reason. In other words, in theory, you could go the way of Kabbalah and say there are many other reasons that are more secretive, but let's at least let the people who are determining halakha find out what these reasons are, and based on all the reasons, determine what the halakha should be. Right? So Rashba seems again to be uncomfortable with that approach without saying as much, for two reasons. Number one, he says, you know, Kabbalah is something you can't share with everyone. Possibly even, it can only be told to the Gadol HaDor. Even here, I'm not so sure about. And if he was speaking about himself. But in any case, right, you can't be discussing these reasons. That's number one. Number two, something else that Rashba says is that the reasons are Ein Sof. There's no limit to the reasons. Right? Again, if you look at Rabbi Nachman's finding, you know, as long as he's alive, every minute there's a new reason for it. Right? So it could be that if you take the Rashba to the logical conclusion, then it seems to stand in opposition to the approach that we've brought. That being said, the Rashba appears to be a minority opinion. So mainstream halakha, is really not determined by Kabbalah. Right? Especially in the last 500 years, there's been a great debate among poskim to what extent you include Kabbalah in Psak. Mainstream, and again, it's hard to say, it depends, you know, my mainstream and someone else's non-mainstream. Certainly in the non-Hasidic, I shouldn't say Lithuanian, the non-Hasidic European world, as well as Chachmei Eretz Yisrael, Chachmei Aram Tzova, Chachmei Teiman, a good part of the Sephardic world also viewed Kabbalah as something that does not dominate. In other words, like the Chatam Sofer said last week, when you have a machloket between the Bavli, the Gemara, and the Kabbalah, you follow the Gemara, right? So if there's a reason that contradicts what we know from what one can figure out reasoning in Tanakh as well as the Gemara, if the Kabbalah says something else, we really don't have to worry about it. We assume it's a contrary opinion, and we don't follow that opinion. It's interesting, by the way, that the author, according to tradition of the Zohar, is Rishon Bar Yochai, which is interesting because he's the one who's finding Time of the Krah. So his Time of the Krah, on Kabbalistic level, is something that we don't listen to. And on a rational level, also Rabbi Yehuda has the day. So Rabbi Shimon seems to lose out in both worlds. That being said, there are areas of... traditions of Psak Halakha that wherein Kabbalah has a great influence in the Hasidic world. It depends on various streams. Certain parts of the Sephardic world, certainly the Ben Ish Chai and the Iraqi school of thought. So again, any time that you get into Kabbalah, it creates problems for us. But for most of us who are not really part of those traditions, the problems are not that relevant against the poskim to the mainstream poskim that most of us follow. It's not really an issue. So in spite of the Rashba, we'll discuss the Nefesh HaChaim says something a little bit similar. We'll discuss in a few weeks' time. Okay, that was loose ends from last week. Are there any questions, any clarifications at this point?
I'll ask two questions. It doesn't take long to answer. Number one, do you know about any shita which holds that perhaps if the Torah gives a time or gives a reason for the mitzvah or the prohibition, that if you know that prohibition, or better, that explanation or that asmara of that mitzvah is not applicable to you, that then by that I don't have to look after that mitzvah, number one. Is there anybody who is making that particular point? And the second question is that, is anybody speaking about why at certain occasions the Torah does give a pirush for why it says this mitzvah, and why at other occasions it does not?
Yeah, so in terms of the second question, the only thing I saw is what I mentioned before, that in terms of chukim, it doesn't want to give, not in terms of chukim, excuse me, in terms of fences, the Torah generally does not want to give reasons. And there's another category that's not a fence, and where the Torah doesn't give reasons, is clearly the chok. Right? Is the chok, if there's value to such a thing as a chok, which is a debate, then perhaps the Torah would want to. I mean, I'm saying this not from a particular source, but more from general knowledge, then the Torah would obviously not want to give the reason there as well. But in terms of a general overview of why in all cases you know, gives reason, in other cases it doesn't, I didn't see anything. Your first question was whether Torah's reason doesn't apply, whether we don't have to keep the mitzvah.
It's Shlomo HaMelech basically
anymore.
Right, but he was wrong only because he couldn't live up to it. But in principle, he's right. It doesn't apply to me.
Yeah, I think it depends between by in principle. Again, I think once the Torah is given, I mean, I think anything I've seen says that we have to keep the mitzvah of the Torah. Whether we understand the reason for it or not, it's interesting. If the reason doesn't apply, there are certain things that you know, korbanot, it's not so much the reasons don't apply, but the conditions don't apply. So, I don't know. I don't know what.
Oftentimes, like Rambam or Sefer Chinuch is probably a good example. They'll say, like, at the shoresh of the mitzvah is a certain principle.
Right.
Is that different than, I would think that would be different from the Tom of the mitzvah. It's just, it's sort of like deriving what's the value that the mitzvah is coming to teach us? Or, I mean, is there an interaction between the two, perhaps?
Not sure. Not sure. I wanted to give you another example to show you far-reaching legal ramifications of understanding the reasons for the mitzvah. There's a mitzvah that's from Dvarim, Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Yutet, that is incumbent on at least all the men here, probably not the women, though I think there is at least one opinion that says women as well, but certainly on all the men in this room. Ve'ata kipu lechem et ha'shira hazot ve'lamda et b'nei Yisrael sinam fihem leman tiuli ha'shira hazot le'ed b'nei Yisrael. Okay, I'll read the whole verse, but what I'm really interested in is the first part of the verse. It says, now write for yourself this poem. Right? What's this poem? That's you have to know the context. But really, halachically, what's the poem speaking about? It's the Torah as a whole. Okay, so write for yourself this poem. Write for yourself this Torah, and learn it or teach it really to the Jewish people. Put it in their mouth in order that it will be for that this song will be a witness for me. Among the Jewish people. Okay? How many people fill this mitzvah? So purchasing chumashim. How can you say such a thing? What a radical explanation you're giving to us. Where's that from?
In the past, that's pretty
expensive
to really get a copy.
Oy vey. Heresy in these walls. Printing presses, modern inventions. So the truth is, that's not 100% clear. It happens to be anybody you know who came up with this idea? There's two people came up with this idea. Sorry? One is the Rush.
The Rush.
The Rush. Okay, so you got it. And the other one is someone who's in the Gaonim, Ben Yerucham, if I'm not mistaken. In any case, the Rush is the one that's brought down. I gave to you last week, I don't know if everybody has, the Orach HaShulchan. He quotes the Rush. If anybody doesn't have it, I have a few copies here. Anybody need it?
Yes.
Okay, I'll pass this back. There's a few copies. Just pass them around to people that need it. Okay, anyway, we'll take a quick look at the Orach HaShulchan, who quotes the Rush. Actually, it's in the Torah. I never found the Rush. I'm sure it's there somewhere. The Torah, as you know, is the Rosh's son. So we can believe him, even if we didn't find the source. Right? And the Aruch HaShulchan is just quoting, in paragraph Zion, is just quoting. Right? What's not said except to the first generations? To do what? To write the Torah. Right at the beginning of Aleph, right mitzvah Aseh, I'll call Echad Mi'Israel, Lichtov, Lo Sefer Torah, Mishaloh. Okay? So it says, so the Aruch Shulchan is bringing the Rush to qualify the statement of the mitzvah, and he says, Shezelo Nema Ele Dorot Rishonim, Shehu Kodvim Sifrei Torah Velom Dimba. Aval Ha'idna, right, what's Ha'idna mean? Nowadays, right? That's Aramaic today, right? So it's only the case for the early generations that would be writing Sifrei Torah and learning from them. But today, Shekodvin Sifrei Torah, Umenichin Otan B'Batei Knesset, Likhot Behen Berabim. But today, what do we do with our Sifrei Torah? We don't learn from them. We just put them in a closet in shul, and we take them out for public readings. So, mitzvah taseh al kol Yisrael asher yado maseget lechtov chumshe haTorah uMishnah veGemara uPirushehen lagot behen hu uvanav. Right, so he says, what should we be doing today? We should be purchasing chumashim, Mishnah, Gemara, Pirushim, right, and study them with our children. Ki mitzvat ketivat haTorah hi kedei lilmod ba. Says the Rosh, because there's a reason for writing a Sefer Torah. We're not just writing a Sefer Torah for decorations. What's the reason? In order to learn from it. That's the reason of the mitzvah. Dichtiv v'lamda et bnei Yisrael, as it's written in the verse, and teach it to the bnei Yisrael, sima b'fihem, put it in their mouths, right, they should be fluent with it, v'al yada gemara v'pirushim, yada pirush ha-mitzvot v'adinin al-buryan. And through the Gemara and its commentaries, we'll know the explanation of the mitzvot and the laws clearly. L'chem, Hem asfarim she'adam mitzuve lechotvam, and therefore these are the books that that were commanded to write. The gam shelo mokram, etc. And then it brings other prati dinim, other details of this law. Okay, says the Rash, there's a reason for the mitzvah of writing a sefer Torah, right? And based on that reason, the form of the mitzvah has changed. Okay, by the way, is he going according to Reb Shimon or according to Reb Yehuda? In other words, is the reason actually given in the verse, or is it something that we have to figure out on our own? Sorry?
Something we have to figure out.
Something we have to figure out on our own. Everybody agree? What?
Doesn't it say to write and teach
in
the
verse?
It does.
It also says the man says the aid.
Right.
That sounds like more.
More the reason. Okay.
Can you just read the pasuk again?
Yeah. Sure. It says Ata kipu lachem et hashira zot velamda et bnei Yisrael sinarfiyam leman tye li hashira zot leed bnei Yisrael. The truth is, it's unclear. I mean, it's unclear. You could say the reason is there. It's certainly not black on white. It's certainly a very strong implication. If you look in the Aruch HaShulchan, in Tet, and which I'm going to read together, the Aruch HaShulchan, without saying as much, tries to make it a Reb Yehuda type of teaching, which obviously has its advantage because we generally follow Reb Yehuda, not Reb Shimon. But be that as it may, even as Reb Yehuda, It doesn't really matter for us that much. What's important in this limud is that the Rush completely changes the format of the mitzvah. Meaning, if the Rush is wrong, and we buy Sfarim instead of writing a Sefer Torah, what have we done? Same thing we were doing last week with our chickens, right, that we failed to send away because we were worried about cruelty. Right, what are we doing? We're being mevatel mitzvat aseh. I have serious business. We're being mevatel. God gave us a law, and we said, we're going to understand it differently. We're going to understand it based on its reason, and if we're wrong, so then we've just lost out on that mitzvah. By the way, I don't know to what extent you looked into the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan discusses the halakhic discussion. There's a machloket about this rush. Anybody remember what the machloket is?
Just right or wrong.
Well, no, it's not the machloket, by the way. It's very interesting. Everybody accepts the rush. The question is something else. Yeah. Read really carefully. Shalom, is your hand up? No. The machloket is whether he's giving an additional interpretation, an additional understanding of the mitzvah, or a replacing understanding of the mitzvah. In other words, is the Rush saying nowadays we also have to write Sifrei Torah, write the Chumashim and Mishnayot and purchase them? Or is he saying, right, we only now have to write, forget about writing and purchasing a Sefer Torah, all you need to do is purchase Gemara, Chumashim, etc. He's saying, you know, now that we study from these books, we also have to buy these books, right? Obviously, one is much more conservative understanding than the other, being the latter. I say no one disagrees. The Shulchan Aruch, I mean, I can say no one, I'm sure that people disagree. But the Shulchan Aruch brings down the Rush. He's not clear in the Shulchan Aruch itself, if I'm not mistaken, but in the Beit Yosef, which is commentary to the Torah, he's quite clear that he's learning the more conservative approach. That the Torah is saying, the Rush is saying, we also have to do this. How, if you look in the Rush, and again, you can look more carefully, the Aruch HaShulchan points out, it's very difficult to learn the Rush that way. The Rush says, that's what they used to do, now we do it differently. These are the books, as opposed to the other ones. Very hard to learn the Rush in the other way. Whenever you have a forced understanding of a text, so you have to try to figure out what's behind it. Now, there's always an agenda. Sometimes the agenda is very legitimate. But a forced reading tells you, look out, red flag, there's an agenda here. Again, there's some super halachic agendas which are legitimate. We'll maybe get to that later in the mini course. But be that as it may, the simple reading of the Rush, and there are those, you know, besides the Aruch HaShulchan, who puts this stamp of approval, the Shach, who's one of the classical commentators in the Shulchan Aruch, and the Drisha, also one of the classical commentaries on the tour, all feel that the reading of the Rush is, he was saying, don't write Sefer Torah. You can if you want. There's no mitzvah to do it. And if you really want to do the mitzvah, you better go to your Sfarim store, because otherwise you're going to miss out on this mitzvah. Right? Halacha l'maaseh, one second. Halacha l'maaseh, by the way, this not only is this Rush a radical reformulation of the mitzvah, and hopefully legitimately so. I mean, I'm not saying it's not legitimate. All I'm saying is that it's a reformulation of the mitzvah based on what he feels are legitimate reasons. And the Rush is an example. The other Rishonim do this as well in other situations. But halach l'maaseh, we actually incorporate this into halachic practice. What do I mean we incorporate it? I just told you the Shulchan Aruch says to do both. The various achronim, including the Kaf HaChayim, the Chayi Adam, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, all say that if you're not able to do both, right, if you have to choose, if your resources are limited, and you can only purchase a Shas, or a Chumah, or a Sefer Torah, then you should purchase what you're going to learn from, which is the Shas, and not the Sefer Torah. Right, by the way, there's a beautiful tirade in the Chayi Adam on this issue about Achnasat Sefer Torah. He says, not only, you know, are you waiting, if the choice is between supporting Talmud Torah on the one hand in writing this Torah, which you may not have to do at all according to the Rush, then you should certainly be purchasing Svarim and helping people who are going to be learning them. Rather, he says, not only you're spending a lot of money on the Sefer Torah, but you throw a big party and you have drinks and food and a parade and candles. And he says it's not a good idea. In any case, yeah. I'm sorry, Yehuda was first.
I just want to ask Rowan something that may seem from a different angle. My question is, and you're categorizing the discussion Tamei HaMitzvot. And here my question is, isn't there another question, or perhaps another way of looking at it, which is Hadarat HaMitzvah? Not even a question, which is even precedes the discussion about the reason, but actually a question of a definition. Because here you have a situation, what is the mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah?
Right.
Is it to learn? If it's to learn, so then writing a Sefer Torah today won't serve the purpose. So maybe a distinction is necessary between a discussion of whether the Rosh is discussing your Tamei HaMitzvah, whether it's germane to this conversation, or it's another question of what is the Hadarat HaMitzvah, what is the definition of the fulfillment of the mitzvah itself?
Yeah, I think it's correct, but the Hadarat in this case is based on a Tam. In other words, it's not simply a question of substance, it's a question of, look at what the Torah says. Again, he brings the verse. He's bringing the verse. It's in order to learn the material. So I think Tom is relevant. I mean, granted, you're right. We have to be magdir the mitzvah. But it's clear that the original formulation of the mitzvah is not that way. The Rosh would agree. But originally, the formulation of the mitzvah is kapshuto, that you write a Sefer Torah. And now that very Hagdara has changed. So what's gone between step A and step B? And I think that the fundamental reason is the foundational explanation, which is based on time.
Is the Hagdara not that, or could you not make a Hagdara out of the question, is the writing the mitzvah, or is the end result the mitzvah?
Or is the what?
The end result the mitzvah. Is it, I need to write the Sefer Torah because we need the Sefer Torah?
Yeah.
So that we can learn from it? Or is the writing itself the mitzvah, because while we are writing it, we are actually learning it?
The problem with that is that Chazal already formulated it one way. As in the Talmud, it's already understood that the mitzvah is to have, is to purchase, is to acquire.
It's strange, because the Pasuk basically says you should
learn. Yeah, that's right, that's right. But that's a different discussion. But once Chazal has said that's not what it is, so then the question becomes, what, given that we have to acquire a Sefer Torah, is it a Gzerat HaKatu? We simply have to acquire a Sefer Torah for whatever reason, and Rashi will tell you Ein Sof reasons, or is it that it has a foundational reason which will shape its contours, as the Rosh is suggesting? Yeah, Ark.
Similar.
I'm going to ask you to wait, I'm sorry, because I have too much material. If there's time at the end, I'll come back to you. There's another discussion that's very pertinent to this, and that's a discussion Hakafat HaRosh. Hakafat HaRosh is what we commonly call peyot, right? Not shaving, not cutting off your peyot. Again, in this case, it's very clear the prohibition is only directed at men. You can find the discussion in Yeridaya, in Yeridaya Kuf Pei Aleph. That's 181. There's a fascinating little discussion between the Tur and the Rambam. Here I'm looking at the Tur. I'm not looking at the Shulchan Aruch when I said Yeridaya of the Tur. In any case, in Kepei Aleph, he says as follows: Hakafat Arosh v'Hashchatat Zaken Gam Be'elu Katav Rambam She'Asram HaKatuv Mipnei She'Osim Ken Ovdei Kochavim Adkan. Right, so it says here also he's talking about Gam, he's talking about other mitzvot such as tattooing, which the Rambam says we don't want to be like the idol worshippers. And the Rambam, concerning not cutting off the corners of your hair, also explains that we don't want to be, this was a practice of idolatry to do such a thing. And that's why we don't do them. Again, the you can look at the psukim. Psukim are Vayikra, Yutet, Chaf, Zayin, 1927. Right? You can look at it later. The psukim don't really say that. They don't say it at all. We'll leave it at that. I'm not saying there are no indications, but in any case, the Rambam says that that's the reason, even though it's not found in the verse. In any case, the tour takes them to task and says, "V'zeh eino mefurash." However, it's not explicit. Again, meaning that if it were explicit, even the Torah would say, if it's in the verse, right? I'm not going to take him to task. After all, he would have to take his father to task, because his father said, you know, following the reason about the Sefer Torah, right? But there, one could argue that it's mifurash, it's explicit. The reason for writing a Sefer Torah could be understood explicitly from the Torah in order to learn from it. But in any case, in the case of peot, in cutting one's beard, cutting off one's beard, that is not mifurash. The Rambam would probably agree to that, even though we said that in some cases we, in any case, follow and look for the reason in our halakhic formulation of the laws. In any case, the tour continues and says, "Ve'ein anu tzrichim levakesh tam lemitzvot." So the tour, we don't need to look for reasons for the mitzvot. Ki mitzvot melech hem aleinu, because they are commandments of a king upon us. Af im lo neda ta'aman, even if we don't know their reasons. So a very strange little discussion back and forth between the Rambam and the Torah. The Rambam, one can ask, why does the Rambam bring these reasons? I mean, does it have... When the Rush brought the reason in terms of learning, there was a halachic ramification. Again, we're not Rabbi Natan here. We're not looking for hashkafic discussions. We're talking about a halachic discussion. So why does the Rambam need to give me the reason if there's no difference? Doesn't make a difference. That's number one. Number two, there's a question on the Torah. Why is the Torah... What problem does the Torah have with Tamei HaMitzvot? Why does he get so upset with the Rambam? I don't want to spend too much time on it because I want to get right to the next topic. But there are those who suggest the nafka mina, a practical difference between the Rambam's approach and not the Rambam's approach, meaning whether it is prohibited because of chukat ha-goy, because we're going to resemble the idol worshippers. I think the Prisha, the Drisha, same person, but he wrote two different commentaries on the Torah. Yeah, it's the Prisha who says that if that's the reason, then there'll be certain cases that it won't apply. And in that case is if a person has a government job, and has to be close to the government, won't get that job if he doesn't shave his beard. Right, back then they had hard, difficult ways of doing it with halachically permissible razors. In any case, it might be permissible for such a person if we follow the Rambam, in which case the tour has a right to get upset at the Rambam, because then there's actually a halachic difference. That was a little quick, I know. If you didn't catch all of it, don't worry. You can look it up yourself if you're interested. It's a further interesting discussion on this point. Okay, I want to move to rabbinic ordinances now. I guess we have a lot to cover in a short amount of weeks. But what I wanted to bring out from the first class up till now, let's just summarize, is that the Torah sometimes does give reasons for its mitzvot, other times it does not give reasons. When it doesn't give reasons, we have a machloket as to, at least in the time of the Mishnah, in the time of the Tanaim, we have a machloket whether we're allowed to take the reasons that we think are implied in the text and base the contours of the halakha on those reasons. That's the position of Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Rav Yehuda disagrees with him. Among the poskim, it's not so clear who we follow. In general, we follow Rav Yehuda. We see, even according to Rav Yehuda, there's plenty of room for mitzvot to be interpreted ad hazman hazeh, up until our time period. The Orach HaShulch, Torah Tmima, was speaking about interpretation of the law not so long ago, and I'm sure the examples are more recent examples. But in any case, we see that poskim use this to try to understand the contours of halakha up until very recent times. Okay? Now, we said that the problem with Doraita laws is twofold. We didn't present it this way, but let's present it this way. Now, the problem in trying to contour halakha in the Doraita area, in laws that come from the Torah, there are two problems. Number one, the Rashba's problem, which is what? What's the Rashba's problem? Do you want to reformulate the Rashba's problem? Sorry? Didn't say anything? That we don't really know. Even when it says what the reason is, we really don't know. And there's the immutability factor. We can't, you know, we're dealing with God. Right? And God is on a different plane, and the Rashba certainly has a point. Right, so that's one problem. We don't really know what God had in mind 100%, even if he tells us. All sorts of issues of communication between God and mankind, if what, etc., etc. Be that as it may, that's reason number one. Reason number two is, we said the Machlokes and Rav Shimon Yehuda, that it could be that legally we're not allowed to figure out what the reason is if the Torah doesn't specifically say what it is. Okay, so all that is in the Torah law, in Doraita law. The introductory class that I gave, our first session, I pointed out that most of what we keep today is not Torah law. Most of what we do today is rabbinic law. Right? Brachot. Most of the prohibitions on Shabbat that we're concerned with are rabbinic in nature. Kashrut also, a lot of the things that we're dealing with, the separation of milk and meat, which is a standard feature of most of our worry, most of, the, of which is rabbinic. Right? The only Doraita prohibition you're going to come to is if you're actually cooking beef and some milk product together and then consume it, even or even cooking, whatever it is. But most, you know, and I once, when I was many years back in America, I wanted to give a enticing title to a class. I don't know what the class was about. Presumably it had something to do with development of halakha. But I entitled it "When Cheeseburgers Were Kosher." Right? Obviously, I had to explain that in this case the cheeseburger was not cooked together, the cheese and the meat weren't cooked together. After the hamburger cooled off, you put the cheese on it. But at some point, presumably before the rabbis prohibited that would have been permissible. Most of what we keep is rabbinic in origin. So even if we go with the maximal position of the Rashba and say that all Doraita law is hands off, you really can't play around with it. You know, it's fine, the Rush did it, but the Rush was the Rush, and we're not the Rush, so let's keep our hands off the Doraita law. Even so, at least 90%, probably more, of halakha is rabbinic in origin. And presumably the two factors that prohibit us or prevent us from playing around with Torah law don't exist in rabbinic law. And I say, presumably it's not so simple. Though I think on some level it is largely true, and hopefully we'll get a clearer picture of that by the end of this class, but certainly in the one or two next few classes. Be that as it may, there is a Mishnah which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, an Eidiot, which does spoil the party for us. Anybody know what I'm referring to? I'm sure the yeshiva guys have already seen this before. In Perek Aleph, Mishnah Hay is a fascinating Mishnah. It's worth studying. Anybody who hasn't studied it before, the variety of commentaries, we're not really going to speak about it today. I'm taking it from the middle of the Mishnah, where it says, "Ein beitin yechol levatel divrei beitin chavero ad shiyeh gadol mimenu bechokma uveminyan." Right? A beitin cannot be mevatel, nullify, right? Can't nullify the words of a fellow court, as a fellow Beit Din, unless it's larger than it in Chokhmah u'Minyan. I'm not going to translate that. I'm sure everybody has an idea. Minyan is number, but there's a whole discussion on what that means. But for our practical purposes, it puts us into the bind that we've been in for the last 1800 years. Once the law is on the books, it stays on the books. All right? Basically, for practical purposes, again, it's a whole discussion, But for all practical purposes, once the law is on the books, it stays on the books, at least until presumably the Messianic era. Okay, so that obviously, by the way, that's very different than the Rashban, it's different than the issue of Rav Shimon and Rav Yehuda. It's a technical problem. We have a technical, there's a law that says, once the law is on the books, you have to have a competent court in order to annul that law. Right? All governmental systems have a way of making laws and abrogating laws. Jewish law is no exception. The problem is that the abrogatory function of legislation no longer exists. In theory it might exist, in practice it doesn't. Yes?
There are mitzvahs, there are abundant that were abrogated.
Right, okay. So we'll get to that. I don't know, what do you have in mind?
Let's say Tzidat Israel was also abrogated.
In their time. But Bizman Azeh, when they did have competent courts, and by the way, they're different issues. And Takanat Ezra is a gzera sheinam am yachol la'amod bo, that may not need a court. It's technical. I don't really want to get into that. It's true that in the time of the Gemara, there's certainly the power was there. Even in the time of the Gemara, there's a concept of Yerida HaDoros. But again, I don't want to get too technical and bogged down for our present discussion. The point for our present discussion is nowadays we don't have that ability, and everybody agrees to that. However, that being said, poskim throughout the centuries have been pointing out that many of the rabbinic law does not apply in different situations because of all sorts of reasons. We'll give today, as well as next week, a variety of examples of such situations. And the first one that I'm going to discuss, something I didn't really to look at, and that is the discussion of Kiddush in Beit Knesset. Right. I don't know how many people come from shuls where they make Kiddush in shul. Yeah, okay. In Chutzlaretz is very prevalent. In Israel, I guess grape juice is expensive. I'm not sure what the reason is. I don't think it's halakhically based. Even though there's a big discussion as to whether it's the appropriate thing. The beginning of the discussion is Iran. Iran is one of the Rishonim, and you find him in this particular case on the Rif, where you sometimes do find him.
Friday night or Saturday?
Yeah, that was my question.
Friday night.
Saturday,
thanks.
Saturday, no, there's no Indian really. Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, again. That's right. That's right. Yeah, well, we're talking about Friday night. By the way, anytime there's something that's not clear, please feel free to interject so that other people will also know what I'm talking about. In any case, Rif in Psachim, Aran Psachim on Daf Yutet Amud Bet and Daf Chaf of the Rif pages. Those of you know what I'm talking about, understand the reference. Those who don't, sorry? Daf Yutet Amud Bet and Daf Chaf Amud Aleph. The Rif points out that there's a problem. What's the reason the Gemara gives that we have Kiddush and Shul? Anybody know? Neha? Sorry? Orachim. It's now Orachim. The Gemara speaks about Orachim and the Stama, yeah, that they're poor. Poor Orachim, what do they do? They're eating in Shul, and you make Kiddush for them in Shul before they eat. Now, there's another discussion. What are they doing in Shul? It's not appropriate, but that's for another day. Regardless, the Iran says, but you know what, that reason doesn't apply today. People don't eat in shul anymore in his time, and presumably in our time also. So what do we do? So you have two possibilities. One is say, well, you know what, once it's on the books, it's on the books, which is what the Iran says. And it's what the Rambam says as well, apparently. I still haven't seen the original. Apparently it's a Rambam in the Tshuvot HaRambam, I think it's Lamed Zion, but I haven't seen the original, so don't quote me on that. I saw it in the Yehavidat Ravadi Yosef. He brings it down in Chelek Bet, where he discusses this topic. Apparently the Rambam agrees on this topic, and the Rambam brings a couple of other places where the Takana is no longer relevant because of the situation. He speaks about Chazarta Shatz, right? What was Chazarta Shatz for? For people who were poor in a different way. They weren't poor monetarily, but they were poor educationally, that they didn't know how to read the Siddur, or didn't have Siddurim. And so therefore there was a public tefillah for them, to be able to be Yotze. The Rambam says, even though the ta'am, right, the language he uses, as far as I know, even though the ta'am, batla ta'am of a lo batla gzera, the reason is batel, the reason no longer applies, but the gzera still does apply. Right? And by the way, why does the Rambam say that? Purely for technical reasons. In other words, there's this legal principle that if you have a gzera, everybody agrees. If you have a gzera, there's nothing you can do about it. The Rambam says this is true also of bracha me'en sheva, birkat me'en sheva, that we say it all seems to be clumped into the Friday night. Friday night we have all sorts of things that don't make sense, but we're in a better mood, so we're willing to deal with them, right? Which is the birkat me'en sheva is the chazan's mini repetition of the Shmona Esrei. Why is it there? Because people, the shuls used to be out in the fields, and people would come late, needed extra time to catch up, so they wouldn't be left alone to walk home in a dangerous way back. So we stretched out the davening. It's a funny reason to have a tefillah, but that's the reason. In any case, the Rambam and others, I think, in fact, the Ran brings this. The Ran does not bring Chazarat Shatz. The Ran does bring this. That here also you have a situation of batla tama, halo batla gezera, that the reason is no longer applicable, but the ordinance still stays on the books. It's interesting, by the way, while we're on it, the issue of me'en sheva, the issue of this little mini repetition of the shalich tzibur on Mariv Friday night, is shrouded in discussion itself. The Tur says we do it, but he gives a different reason. He says minhag avoteinu biyadeinu, which is very different. And what's very interesting is, in spite of the fact that we do it, it would appear that the idea that we're doing it because of gezerah is not agreed by many. The reason I'm saying that is because in a Beit Avel and a Beit Chatan, we don't have the Me'en Sheva. We don't say this bracha. If the Friday night davening happens to be a Beit Avel and Beit Chatan, again, halachically you can give tirutzim for that. But be that as it may, it's an interesting discussion. Also of note, the Kaf HaChayim, who is the Iraqi Kabbalistically influenced school, says, how can you not say in a Beit Chatan, Beit Avel? There's a million reasons for this blessing, right? Reminding us of who? What does it remind you of? Wasn't that long ago? The Rashba, right. Reminding us of the Rashba. So what the Rashba did on a Deraita level, all of a sudden you see Kabbalistically influenced Chachamim doing on a rabbinic level. He doesn't go as far as, even though he does say that there's Ein Sof reasons, he doesn't go as far as the Rashba, as really literally meaning the Ein Sof reasons, but that according to Kabbalistic reasons, you should always be saying it because the reasons apply also in a Beit Avel. Put that on the side. In any case, we said that the Ran and the Rambam feel that we should still be doing this Kiddush on Friday night. The Beit Yosef says that's not what they're doing in Israel, and they're right. Okay? Why are they right? What do you mean? How could it be? Just heard that was a gezerah. So says the Beit Yosef, no, it wasn't a gezerah. How do I know? Because people aren't doing it. People wouldn't be breaking gezerah, so it must be there was never a gezerah. I'm speculating a little bit on that. The truth is, there's a big problem in this issue of not rescinding gzerot, because the Talmud doesn't tell us what's a gzera and what's a minhag. The Talmud is not organizes a law book in the classical Greek sense. Like we have the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch. Right? Those are Greek books. They organize things in a more misudar order in order to give over information. It's an aside. It's not really important for now. But in any case, very few times do we know when something is really gzera. So whereas the Ran says, here you have a gzera, you can't break gzera. Others, like the Beit Yosef, says, no, it's not gzera. We told you it was a gzera. Right, so that is a strategy of nullifying rabbinic laws when the reason doesn't apply. It's going to be a more difficult strategy because you're treading on thin waters. Obviously, if you have a minhag, and we'll speak about minhag more in the future, obviously if you have a minhag, people are already not doing something, and you're assuming that, you know, kosher Jews have kosher rabbis who instructed them to not keep something that the Gemara spoke about. So the assumption is that those kosher rabbis had some way of knowing that it wasn't a gezerah, an ordinance. Because that's one strategy brought out by the Beit Yosef. I wanted to skip to the Igret Moshe very quickly. The Igret Moshe, I don't know how many people got a chance to read it. The main paragraph I really was interested in was on the last page that I gave you. The rest is really background. Right, famous tshuva. I don't know if you noticed. If you looked at it carefully, you'll notice that there was someone who was really intent on prohibiting halavakum. Rav Moshe in the first tshuva says, it's fine. So then the guy says, yeah, but there's more problems. So Rav Moshe writes another tshuva and he says, okay, I'll answer your problem. And you know what? It's fine. So the guy writes another shayla and says, but Rav Moshe, there's more problems. Rav Moshe says, it's really fine. Right? You can just see the back and forth. Rav Moshe, in the tradition of Hillel, was a very patient man and answered everything in a mechubad way. In any case, in the last tshuva of this is Mem Tet 49, as I mentioned before. This is from the first chelek of Yeridea of the Igrot Moshe. Right? Igrot Moshe is divided into sections of the Shulchan Aruch. In any case, he speaks about Mem Tet. No, you didn't get the beginning of Mem Tet, so you don't realize it's Mem Tet. But it's the last page that you got.
In the page
Pei Zayin, that's right. Right? He says that in the middle of the page where I asked you to start from, he says, Lachen, Absher Vadai, I mean, I probably should give a little bit of background before we go right into this. The contention, what was Rav Moshe's point? Forgetting about the Gezerah to begin with, what's the background? What's his point? Why? We know that the Mishnah tells us you're not allowed to. This is the Mishnah in Avodah Zarah Lamed He. I think it's Avodah Zarah Lamed He Amud Aleph. The Mishnah over there says, this is a short discussion, by the way, in the Gemara, if you want to see what's going on. It's only a few lines. But in any case, the Mishnah over there says that we're not allowed to have milk that's milked by a non-Jew, except for what? When? Everybody know? Except for when? A Jew is watching, right? If a Jew is watching, so then you know that the milk is kosher. What do I mean about kosher? What makes the milk kosher or not kosher? The animal is a kosher animal, right? As opposed to a pig or more commonly a mule, right? A donkey.
Nothing else is mixed in.
Yeah, that's you see from beginning to end. Or when, the details of the halakha are not so relevant, not so important for us. But in any case, we want to know if governmentally regulated milk is okay or not. Now, from a simple reading of the Mishnah, the answer should be, what? No, simple reading of the Mishnah is not. There are people who disagree with Rav Moshe and say, what are you talking about? What's Rav Moshe's line of argument? Why is it permissible? Why is governmental supervision permissible? What do you mean you can rely upon them?
They're as good as having a Jew standing there.
Yeah, it's the same thing. And there's what's the Jew standing there? And there's no abracadabra that a Jew turns it, you know, like people think, Rabbi make a blessing and becomes kosher, right? The reason the Jew is there is a biru, we call in halakha a biru. It's a clarification. We're trying to clarify information. If the information is already clear, there's no need for this bureau. Says Rav Moshe, there's no difference between one type of bureau and another. So Rav Moshe takes the first hurdle and says, okay, the reason, essentially what he's saying, is the reason for the prohibition doesn't apply. What about the big hurdle that we mentioned? Technically, Rav Moshe, it's in the books. So Rav Moshe says, you're right, it is in the books. How does he get out of it? So let's take a look very quickly in the middle of that paragraph. Lechen. Mamish, right in the middle. Lechen. Page Zion's second column, last paragraph. Everybody should have...
Lechen Asher Adai?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was indicated in the electronic assignment that you should have all gotten. Lechen. Avshavadai gazru ze b'minyan, right? Minyan, remind you, idiots. Even though this was formulated as a law by a number, right, by a formal beitin, kevan shemidina hayamuta elo chiach mize sha'amu, that it says that since the actual milk is not prohibited. If you have kosher milk from a non-Jew, it's permissible. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with it. And since that's the case, right, you can't prove from the fact that there was a gezerah she'asru af kasheim shum chashash iruv. You can't tell me that they forbade, in other words, that when they passed their law, that they also forbade such milk, even when there's no possibility that there's a mixture. As when did the rabbis make their takana? In what situation? The situation where there's a possibility of an admixture. Says Rav Moshe, but if there's no such possibility, they never had that in mind. It wasn't part of the original decree. Okay, that's the main point. We're running out of time, so I just want to make sure we understand this. This is going to be a much more popular strategy than the Beit Yosef in getting around halakha. Again, we're not looking for artificial ways of getting around halakha. The Rav Moshe sincerely believes that this was not part of the gzeirah. As part of rabbinic tradition, and you see this, just to give Rav Moshe's interpretation, we'll see it already in the Rishonim and next week, is that Chazal, the rabbis, when they did make their laws, they made them in a very concrete, very succinct, and very precise fashion. And that the rabbis would not want us to be keeping laws, generally speaking, where there's no reason for them. Okay, again, we're getting back to the issue of reason. There are exceptions to that, right? In other words, the we saw about Kiddush on Er Shabbat, those people who say we should be doing it, are saying, you know what, hey, unless you go with the Kaf HaChaim, I'm not talking about the Kaf HaChaim, it speaks about Kabbalistic reasons. I'm speaking about the Rambam and the Ran, who are Litvisha Svaradim, right? They're saying that there was a law in the books, and in this case, the rabbis did want us to keep it, even when the reason would not apply. However, as we'll see later on, we'll see next week, we have many, many cases where the various poskim looked around and said, you know, the reason doesn't apply, and it can't be that the rabbis had this in mind. By the way, one more good source I don't want to not mention to you in terms of Batla Tama, Lo Batla Gezeras, Tosfot on Psachim Daf Nun Amud Alf. You want to take a look over there in terms of Bitul Melacha on Erev Pesach. Psachim Nun Amud Aleph. There's only one Tosfot, Tzirani Divrei Matril. One avenue we're going to go and follow Poskim, basically the topic of the next shiur or two, is when the reality changes, whether it's the physical reality that the objects that they were talking about don't exist or have changed so much that they're not the same objects anymore, or when social situations are so different than the situation that the rabbis actually made their law in, that they also didn't have in mind such a situation when they proclaimed their takanah.